It's Mel Robbins, host of the Mel Robbins Podcast. I don't want you to miss out on the life you could be living. I mean, just imagine how different your life would be if you had the tools to go from thinking about what you wanted to actually taking action and making it happen. Well, this is your chance to find out how different your life could be. I just created a free training that has over 2 hours of premium video curriculum. It even comes with a companion workbook that is 29 pages long. Do not let another year of your life go by wishing things were different. Go to melrobbins.com/make it happen and allow me to help you make it different.
Fire. Thanks. I don't need help. Just watch me love myself. That's all I want. Got what I want. That's all I want. I'm not sorry.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray.
And this is Love to See It, an obsessively detailed recap podcast about The Bachelor and other pop culture that makes us laugh, cry, and curse the patriarchy.
We can't live with these shows, and we can't live without them, but we can break down every juicy moment and unpack all the weird messages these shows send us about love, sex, and dating.
Welcome to Love to See It, a podcast where we get a real in-depth lesson in how to watch reality TV like a sociologist.
Reality TV is a cultural product, and just like any other cultural product, it can tell us so much about ourselves, our social roles and expectations, our values, and the narratives we tell about ourselves and about each other.
Now, we really try to watch these shows critically, and there are a lot of ways to do that. But one way, which we wanted to explore in depth this week, is through a sociological lens, which helps us see what these shows, in all their messy glory, reflect and reveal about our society.
Yeah, it's a real, like, zoom out framework.
So today we're talking to Danielle J. Lindemann, an associate professor of sociology at Lehigh University, about her fascinating new book, True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us.
Welcome, Danielle. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
Emma is a sociology major, so she kind of dabbled in sociology a little bit before. To me, a lot of this was brand spanking new, very fresh information. What a wild ride.
I was just getting really excited every time I saw Judith Butler name drop because that was really like my jam in college a million years ago now. But like, I read a lot of Judith Butler because I took a lot of gender courses. So
I teach a lot of gender courses.
Yeah, fantastic.
So I assign a lot of Judith Butler. So I was asking you before, did any of the sociological terms, like, did you remember them? Did you pull them from the recesses of your mind?
Yeah, some of them. A lot of it was like, yes, Durkheim. I do recall that name. Durkheim exists.
It made me feel just old. Like riding a bike, remembering Durkheim.
But it did really make me think about how much of the way that we talk about The Bachelor on our podcast feels like at least lightly influenced by my low-key academic background in sociology, like so much about the performance of gender and all of that. And so I'm really excited to get into this book with you because it was such a fun read. I was like obsessively underlining every page.
I love to hear that. My students often ask me like, what can you do with a degree in sociology? This is one thing that you can do. It's
you
amazing.
Can podcast.
You can podcast.
So let's dive in with a little bit of your background, Danielle. What has been your relationship with reality TV and why did you want to write a book about it?
Oh, yeah. So I often say kind of my whole life has been, people ask me about the research for this book. My whole life has been in research for this book, or at least since I was kind of a teenager and I first discovered the real world. So, I mean, I am a fan. I'm unabashedly a fan. You know, I kind of position myself that way in the book. But even though I'm a fan, I recognize that there's kind of ugly things about reality TV, or it exposes kind of ugly elements of our culture. So I'm kind of upfront about that in the book. But I also don't think that I would be such a fan if I didn't really believe in the kind of positive kind of transformative power of reality TV. So I'm an evangelist for reality TV. I think it can be an amazing sociological tool and it can teach us so much about ourselves and our culture.
Is there a reality series that to you just like means reality TV that like is the seed of your passion for it?
I think the seed of my passion was I was a young kind of teenager on Long Island and I started watching, we had just gotten cable, and I started watching The Real World London, which was not the first season of The Real, it was like the fourth season of The Real World. But I, just something about this program just drew me in. It really hooked me, which is interesting because apparently that season was supposed to be incredibly boring. The showrunners like, never showed it in reruns. They said it was a disappointment. Jonathan Murray said it was a disappointment. But to me, like, there was just something that drew me to that show. And I, like, neglected my homework. And my mom was convinced I wouldn't get into a good college because I was so obsessed, like, just recording this episode of VHS tapes and watching them back. So I think for me, that was just sort of the hook that really drew me into reality TV.
And then did you expand your repertoire beyond that once you were hooked?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, once I was hooked, I think so the next hook came for me when I discovered The Real Housewives, The Real Housewives of Orange County. And then they started like going out into other franchises. That's definitely a show that really hooked me in. And then RuPaul's Drag Race, absolutely kind of maybe I was straying from reality TV, that pulled me back. Especially as someone, you know, who teaches women and gender and sexuality studies classes. It's such an amazing kind of sociological tool.
So how do you think that having a sociological lens on reality TV can shift the way that viewers engage with it? Like, what does looking at it as a sociologist really bring to your viewing of reality shows?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, I think as I tell my, so I teach a class on the sociology of reality TV at Lehigh University. And, you know, I often tell my students, like, we're going to learn all these kind of ugly things that reality TV shows us about ourselves. But at the same time, right, we can use that knowledge. Watching reality TV doesn't make us bad people, or else I'm a bad person too, right? Or most of the populace are bad people because most of us are watching it, millions of us are watching it. It doesn't make us bad people, but sort of having this critical lens looking at reality TV, it can help us understand really kind of our social inequalities. You know, it puts on full blast kind of our racism, our sexism, our classism, our heteronormativity, our materialism. So it really shows us some of the ugliest things about ourselves. But looking at it through the sociological lens can really be useful because then we can really understand those kind of dimensions of our society. And again, the things that we might want to change.
Yeah, I love hearing you put it that way, because to me, that really feels like what we hope the central thesis of our podcast is, I think.
I know.
I think that is how we want to use reality TV and how we want to encourage the people who listen to this show who also want to engage with reality TV in like a responsible, critical, and interested way. So I feel just very like a warm hug of affirmation from you, really, is what I'm saying.
Oh, likewise. We're kindred spirits.
Yes, absolutely. Because there is something about reality TV being this extreme funhouse mirror. And I think that that's something that you talk about a lot in the book, is the way that this reflection of tropes, but then magnified, almost makes it easier for us to identify what's going on in the culture around us, where maybe these things might appear in a much more subtle way.
Exactly. It kind of puts on full blast these elements of our culture, which other forms of media show as well, but really, again, in this kind of amplified way. And so by kind of tracing the contours of those caricatures, we can really better see ourselves.
Why do you think that is? Like, what is it about reality TV that makes it easier to see those things?
So I think one of the things is that it's ostensibly people just being themselves, even though we know, right, that reality TV isn't always quote unquote real, right? It's curated, it's cut, it's edited, specific people are chosen. So it can kind of get away with a little bit more in some ways, in ways that script, in terms of, you know, promotion of stereotypes, right, in ways that scripted TV may not be able to get away with because someone kind of has to be writing it. even though people are kind of writing reality TV in some ways, because, you know, they can just say, well, no, these are just real people behaving in real ways, right? Even though that's not necessarily always true. So I certainly think the ostensibly unscripted format is what kind of allows it to kind of go buck wild in a lot of ways.
Yeah, that's interesting because it's, I think it's very true, but also we are, I think, seeing so much scrutiny starting to be put on some of these shows in terms of whether they are intentionally making choices and crafting what they put on screen in ways that are harmful. And, you know, are these shows perpetuating racism? Are they perpetuating really harmful stereotypes? Do you think that that way of looking at reality shows is, I don't want to say misplaced, but like by doing that, are we potentially like taking away a tool for seeing what's really going on in our society? Or is looking at these shows as something to themselves be altered? Is that a tool for fixing society in reverse almost? Mm. Like how do you think we should be looking at that balance of saying, well, this is a great way to hold a mirror up to the worst parts of our culture versus by holding up a more flattering image, we can shift the way that people actually think.
Yeah, it's such a difficult balance, right? I mean, I think we should always be more circumspect about the media that we produce and that we consume. So ideally, reality TV wouldn't promote such, you know, like ostentatious racial and gendered and sexualized stereotypes, right? I mean, an ideal world, but the truth is that they do. And even though there does seem to be a little bit of acknowledgement about that now, and maybe a little bit of the moving of the needle, just in terms of, you know, trying to diversify casts like The Bachelor and The Bachelorette, mm-hmm. which I know you talk about. Even though there does seem to be moving of the needle a little bit, I mean, still fundamentally, these shows are really promulgating some, you know, pretty gnarly stereotypes that have existed in our culture for hundreds of years. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. But I would say as a person, yes, ideally they wouldn't promote stereotypes, but they do. And because they do, we can use them as kind of a teaching tool.
Right. So it's almost like holding two truths at the same time or two different goals. Like this is a cultural product that exists. Ignoring that it exists and is popular is just sort of burying your head in the sand. So instead, use it as a tool and look at it critically. And at the same time, hold the powers that be responsible for not perpetuating harmful stereotypes and inequalities. And like, can we kind of do both at the same time? Maybe is a challenge for us as consumers.
Yeah, I never understand the people who really want to ignore that it exists, because that's just empirically false, right? Like, whether you like it or not, it exists. Millions of people are consuming this. More people are watching it than not. We've seen the way that it influences our culture. So whether you're a fan or not, this is a cultural juggernaut. I'd actually be interested in hearing whether you two kind of receive pushback, because, I mean, your jobs also revolve around reality TV. I mean, oftentimes people, I kind of get the pushback that this is kind of like not a realistic mm-hmm. or worthwhile object of study, and this is kind of just this frivolous thing. Why are we even giving it more attention, you know? And to me, that really ignores the sort of potency of reality TV that in demonstrable ways.
I think we definitely have received that external criticism. I think especially at the beginning when we were starting it and around, you know, we were doing the podcast during the run up to the 2016 election. And I remember getting so many tweets that were like, how dare you talk about reality TV when there's an election? I was like, well, oddly, I can pay attention to both at the same time.
And they're related.
And there's lots to take, you know, but I think there is, and even now, I'll sometimes get like shock from people in my life or new people I meet being like, well, but you're such a smart woman who considers herself a feminist. How can you watch mm-hmm. The Bachelor? And it's so fascinating because I think we feel that that's exactly the reason that we engage with the right. show like The Bachelor. Although we also, I think, have had a lot of internal conflict about tying ourselves to this kind of inherently problematic franchise. So we've received a push-pull both internally and externally.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I can imagine in an academic context, I mean, for us, I think ultimately we do have people who choose to listen because they want to watch the show or they want to hear about it through this lens. And sometimes we'll hear, oh, I don't want to watch anymore myself, but it's great that you're still doing this. In an academic realm, and I mentioned I come from an academic background myself, I feel like there isn't a lot of respect for this kind of text in a lot of settings. And so has that been challenging for you to, do you ever feel like you have to like make the case for why this is worth study?
Oh, all the time. Yeah. And I feel like, well, anytime you're studying so-called kind of low culture in academia, mm-hmm. it kind of has a stink attached to it, right? The stigma. Like if I were studying opera, I wouldn't be encountering the same kind of criticism. But reality TV is almost the lowest of the low in some ways.
Yeah.
If I were studying, you know, there are people who study like football or, you know, sports who I don't think receive the same level of pushback as I do. And honestly, I think some of that is gendered, right? Because reality TV is this cultural product associated with, you know, everyone's watching, but more often it's women viewers, right? Women on the screens more often than men, right? And we love to devalue cultural products that are related to women, right? Like chick flicks.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. No, you've never heard that before, have you? So yeah, there's definitely that. I believe the pushback is gendered, absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case, especially the contrast with sports is always so telling because they are sort of the same thing.
Well, people, yes, like what in a value lot of ways. Do you get from reality TV? And it's like, well, first of all, I don't have to get a value. I can just enjoy it, right? We can just consume things because we like them, right? Just like, you know, I would never, you know, degrade somebody for enjoying football, even though I don't like football. Right?
What and value no one has ever explained to me what value football gives a viewer that sounds any different from what you might get from following a reality
yes.
show. So
it's very similar.
I am left unconvinced. But let's get into The Bachelor a little bit. I know it's not the main focus of your book, but this is a Bachelor recap podcast. And so we were wondering for our listeners who do watch The Bachelor, when we're watching a Bachelor show, in particular, what tropes or narratives should we be attuned to? Like, what are some of the top ones that spring to mind as being like really central to the Bachelor franchise?
Oh, there's so many. So I think
it's a big question.
I know. Well, I write about the Bachelor kind of periodically throughout the book because it touches on so many different themes.
I was gonna say it's pretty present actually for anyone who is thinking about purchasing this book and is a Bachelor fan. The Bachelor comes up in like almost every chapter.
Because it does touch on so many things. Race, gender. I mean, even just thinking about, you know, again, gender and gender performance, right? When you look at a show like The Bachelor, where you have sort of these women who are doing this, again, exaggerated performance of gender, right? Eyelashes, like 2 feet long eyelashes, wearing sequin ball gowns at 10 a.m. and drinking champagne, but never eating, obviously. Right? So you see this kind of exaggerated performance of femininity, and you might be tempted to say, oh, those are just wacky people, like doing wacky things on reality TV. But, you know, we're all performing gender in muted ways. Some of these same expectations that we see being performed on The Bachelor, expectations for what a woman is, what femininity should be, you know, we're all doing that in our everyday lives. We're just acceding to it in kind of more muted ways, not in these exaggerated sequin ball gown kind of ways. So gender, absolutely. Heteronormativity, huge theme on The Bachelor, right? I mean, will there ever be a gay bachelor? I would probably say no. But the whole idea is, right, it's just women. It's the idea, expectation that women are going to be attracted to men to women, right? They're only going to pair up as a dyad, right? It's only going to be two people, right? Very seldom, sometimes they don't pair up in the end, but that's very seldom, right? Typically, it's defined, and then it's associated with marriage, right? And it's always associated with love, right? That's the right reason, right? Here for the right reasons, the right reason being love. Obviously, like, you're not going to be in a couple unless it's related to loving that person and maybe moving toward marriage. So you can see these kind of very conservative and narrow ways of thinking about being in a relationship kind of being perpetuated on this show. And yes, they're kind of hyped up to the extreme where people are getting married to someone they've only known for 6 weeks or whatever, right? But those expectations permeate our everyday life too, in terms we think about, you know, what makes a relationship real, what makes a relationship authentic, and what are kind of the right reasons for being in a relationship with somebody.
Yeah, I mean, the show really is just like the ultimate vehicle for conservative compulsory heterosexuality.
Yes! Oh, that's a great way of phrasing it. Yeah. And it's interesting because, like, reality TV, you think about it being so zany, right? Like, those are those wacky, outrageous people. But, you know, as I say in the book, in some ways, reality TV is the least zany. It's the most conservative content on TV in terms of its values.
Yeah, that's completely true. And, you know, you brought up the idea of homophily in the chapter on couples, in which The Bachelor looms large, and the idea that we should pair off with people that we share a lot of traits in common with. And if we don't, that it's sort of illegitimate, and it should be for reasons of love and compatibility. And it can take such a minor difference on a show like The Bachelor to say, like, oh, well, like, I don't think that this woman who, like, has a different hairstyle would, like, fit into your lifestyle the same way as a woman who has hair more like women that you know, probably. You know, like, such a small detail can violate that on The Bachelor and sort of induce the other contestants to start saying, like, I don't think that you two can really fall in love because you're too different.
That's
you
a
don't
good point.
Like, you don't, you're not compatible because you have incompatible hairstyles or come from different backgrounds, or your parents are divorced and hers are still together.
Yeah. But again, that's kind of this sort of augmented mirror of real life, where in real life, we do have this homophily, right? As you point out, where we do tend to pair up with people who are quote unquote like us demographically. And that's kind of the social expectation. There's that great quote from the SNL skit where it was like the virgin hunk or whatever, where the woman comes on and says,
God, I love that.
I'm black and I have short hair, so goodbye. Right?
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
She's out before she even begins.
I remember even when Becca Martinez was on The Bachelor, and it was literally just the short hair that was.
So, like, she was
that
a
made
hot 23-year-old white woman, and they were like, the short hair. She is deviant.
Didn't she, like, disappear on a pot farm and her mom had to track her down?
Oh, yeah. So while she was filming the show, she had, like, maybe neglected to tell her mom that while it was airing, she was going to be working on a pot farm with her friend. And so her mom, after she came off the show, reported her missing, is my recollection.
Yes, but she was not actually
But she was fine. She was fine in the end. And yeah, and despite her short hair, has been able to live a happy and fulfilled existence.
Who would have known?
Going
shocking,
the show.
Truly.
So you also were talking a little bit about gender as a social performance on the show, and the way that reality TV can kind of showcase the performance of gender while also reifying it as something that is innate rather than socialized. And, like, how does The Bachelor create this optimal setting for that performance? Like, what is The Bachelor doing structurally to bring that performance out in its contestants?
I mean, I think you nailed it now I can't quote you, but you said something about, you know, how it's this perfect vehicle for the performance of kind of heteronormative femininity, right? Because the whole aim is, and it's sort of a throwback to this kind of old school, like, courtship structure, right? Which I think is very comforting to a lot of people who view the show, right? Who maybe would like to see gender roles kind of go back to this kind of ostensibly more kind of traditional time, which doesn't even really exist, as I talk about in the book. There was no kind of like golden era of traditional gender roles. But, you know, there's a lot of kind of cultural anxiety about changing gender roles, changing racial roles, you know, what have you. And the Bachelor is kind of a pacifier for that in a way. And it does kind of serve as like an excellent stage for, again, this the very premise, right, is that two kind of heterosexual people performing gender in very normative ways, right? Oh, not threatening at all the way they're performing gender, are going to hook up with each other, and they're going to be pretty similar on most kind of demographic characteristics. That's kind of the whole premise of the show, which does kind of make it an amazing platform for observing the gendered expectations that we have, as well as like racial and class expectations as well.
Yeah. I mean, even just thinking about like the rose ceremonies and the attire that is, you know, almost required of the women at these rose ceremonies, the gowns, the like.
Remember when a woman wore a jumpsuit and then went home night one? Like,
yeah,
never
how
again.
Dare you? How rebel. Dare you? I mean, there's a reason that, like, you know, Miss USA and Miss America pageantry just feeds right into The Bachelor. Like, you have so many pageant girls, like almost women who are almost used to doing feminine drag, essentially, like really thrive in a setting like The Bachelor. And we just, like, in last week's episode, right before we taped this, we saw the pretty woman date that they have. And that is, like, extreme conservative gender performance.
Yeah.
It's just, oh, God, it really is. It really is a beautifully rich text.
Yeah. They do. They have these dates that are just beautiful opportunities for women to dress themselves in a seductive, feminine way, and also to like play the role of like the traditional feminine role of like the receiver of gifts.
So grateful.
Yeah, the grateful recipient of gifts.
Something else that we think about a lot that we want to ask you about is that, obviously, as you alluded to before, women make up the vast majority of the Bachelor audience. And some of these women are, of course, women who do kind of buy into the gender roles that we see aped on the show. But there's also a large group of women who are critical of those roles and yet still really love to watch and consume this kind of content. So I was wondering, like, why you think women are drawn to programming that reinforces harmful cultural stereotypes about women.
I mean, I think it's a mixed bag, right? I think to some extent, so there are the people who are sort of watching it analytically and critically, like probably us here, right? But also having fun with it as well. I think there are the people who, you know, studies show that some people are drawn to reality TV for kind of voyeuristic reasons, right? There's the train wreck, right? You watch the train wreck to remind yourself that you are not of you might be messed up in your own unique, you know, interesting ways, but you're not at least like, you're not like in the
I'm
rose
not
ceremony.
That bad. Yeah, I would never do
right?
that.
I'm not like throwing a glass of wine in someone's face right after a rose. I'm not, you know, that jumpsuit woman, right? So it's this sort of social distancing where you're saying, okay, great. At least I'm not that person. It's kind of hierarchical distancing as well. But I mean, I think, you know, women obviously also kind of internalized misogyny and sexism as well. So it's reasonable to believe that that's, you know, that's one of the reasons that they're drawn toward the show as well.
Yeah.
Oh, I wanted to say something about drag, though. I when you were talking about drag, like, that's so interesting to me because I do say that in the book that, you know, reality TV shows us so many dragged up performances of gender, only some of which are actually done by drag queens, right? There's RuPaul's Drag Race, but then there's The Real Housewives, then there's The Bachelor, right? Who are doing these kind of augmented performances of femininity. And Judith Butler,
yes.
your favorite, right? She talks about, right, how drag actually, you know, can show us, by looking at this kind of augmented form of gender, it can show us kind of the gendered expectations that permeate our everyday lives.
And this is why Judith Butler blew my fucking mind in college. I was like, oh, now I understand. Like, when you frame the all performances of gender as performances, it makes it much easier to grasp how gender operates in our culture. Like, it almost feels like a simple concept, but it makes so much sense. Like, just the idea that we are all waking up in the morning and we are all performing the gender identity that we connect to or that we've been assigned in some capacity. And The Bachelor is just such an obvious example of that. Like, there is such a maintenance required in order to do well on the show.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there's something about the way that the show handles it in contrast to some other shows that maybe linger more over the transformation process, that I think that The Bachelor typically doesn't show a lot of them getting ready, making that transition. And so it does, I think, create more of an illusion that, like, this is just how women look. Mm-hmm. Like, just women have eyelashes yeah. out to the other side of the room, and women's hair is always shiny and falls in soft waves. To the point that, like, sometimes when I watch other shows, like, for example, Too Hot to Handle on Netflix, we see a lot of the women getting ready and how much contouring they're doing and their hair, how it's up in a, you know, clips at night or a bonnet. And my instinctive reaction is to be offended on their behalf, like mm-hmm. that they're being exposed in this way, because I think shows like The Bachelor have played into this expectation that I have, this social expectation that women are just presented. They are beautiful. You only see them once they've gone through this beauty process. And that is sort of their acceptable public self. And so I think that the way that I react to shows that reveal more of the process of putting on feminine drag is revealing, like, of what the show that I watch most is kind of selling me. And then we see that also in the way that they used to do often those dates where the bachelor creeps in at 5 a.m. and wakes them all up, and he wants to see them without makeup, which really, I think, does play into the idea that it's sort of a trick if they are putting on a lot of makeup, doing a lot of hairstyling, that they should just look just as beautiful at 5 a.m. when Sean Lowe sneaks into their dorm and wakes them up. So there's just a lot to unpack with how The Bachelor does this. But another thing we wanted to talk about related to gender and The Bachelor is sex, and mm-hmm. how the franchise kind of holds a mirror up to our cultural attitudes about sex, like our obsession with it, our desire to control it. And one thing that is really distinctive about The Bachelor is the fantasy suite. And we were curious about your thoughts on the fantasy suite and how it functions in the world of The Bachelor as, like, a tool of sexual regulation.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So the fantasy suite. I mean, just, there's so much to say about The Bachelor and sexuality in general. I mean, so it's this kind of dual expectation, especially for women, mainly for women, right? That you should be sexual, but you should not be sexual, right? Or you have to be sexual in the right times, in the right ways, with the right people, for the right reasons, right? and so, you know, within the fiction of the show, that is that kind of fantasy suite is, you know, these are the, within the sexual regulations of the show, that fantasy suite is, okay, that's the acceptable spot for your kind of sexuality to occur, for your sexual behavior to occur, but not really kind of before. Because if you kind of, like, sloppy kiss before, I mean, everyone's kissing, but, you know, if you kind of do too much before then, it's kind of that slap down. And it kind of, if you really don't do anything in the fantasy suite, then that's kind of slap down. You kind of need to, like, hit the sweet spot of sexuality where it's like Goldilocks' porridge, right? Where it's like, just right. And I think that does, like, highlight these paradoxical expectations that we have for women, like the virgin whore dichotomy, right? Which, you know, has been written about a lot, sort of this idea that, yep, you have to be this vixen, but you also have to refrain from sexuality to kind of increase your value to men, right? There's a certain sexual economy there. You still, right, where if you give away sexuality too freely or too soon, then your stock will plummet.
Yeah, there's something about the fantasy suite that's almost like a little pseudo marriage that says this woman only had sex when someone said it was okay. And so she's good. Like, she's doing sex the right way. She's waiting for the little light to go on, the little, like, bell to ring. That's like, time for you to show your man how you love him with your body. And
And we've seen it.
That kind of demonstrates her virtue.
We've seen it so clearly punished when women, you know, overtly have sexual experiences outside of that, you know, quote unquote, correct moment and setting. We saw it on Caitlin Bristow's season of The Bachelorette, which is when we started our podcast, and she was stuck in Ireland for like a month after she had sex with Nick Vile. and also when Claire Crawley and Juan Pablo had a sexual experience in the ocean, and then he literally like berated her, essentially, like criticized her very openly and said, like, my daughter is watching this show, as if she had sort of seduced him into doing something untoward. Like, mm-hmm. you see these just very clear demarcations on the show of what's right and what's not. And something that I'm interested in as well is the way that we've seen these small shifts in the discourse around sex within the world of The Bachelor. Like, I think Caitlin Bristow's season and the season before, where Nick Vile brought up the fact that he had had sex with Andy Dorfman during the after the final rose, that sort of almost, I think, operated as a way to allow the show to begin speaking more openly about sex. And I wonder what your thoughts are on, like, the way that the fantasy suite and these, like, kind of small deviations from that model frames the discourse around sex within Bachelor world, or perhaps reflects cultural changes in the way we think about sex in the outside world.
Yeah, so I certainly think that the show is somewhat nuanced in the way that it treats sexuality, especially female sexuality. You know, as I talk about in the book, there is this kind of tension where on the one hand, it's kind of presenting its expectations for female sexuality in very conservative ways. But on the other hand, it kind of shows us kind of how we have kind of become more progressive over time about in relation to female sexuality, right? I mean, these women, they're hooking, like, sometimes they're smooching a guy they just met, right? So in some ways, and you know, theoretically, that's like, they have agency, right? They're showing women who have agency over their own sexuality in some ways, right? I mean, again, yes, Claire, your point taken about the light going on, and then, yes, giving permission to, like, now you may be sexual, right? But they are kind of showing women as sexual beings. Mm-hmm. So, yes, it has kind of shown how the needle has been moved, and they are talking more openly. I take your point over time about the women on these shows being sexual. At the same time, oftentimes they're kind of sexual in ways that, again, kind of reify conventional ideas about gender, right? About
right.
women, right?
they're not straying so, too far.
They're not straying. I mean, they're not like wearing jumpsuits or anything crazy like that.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Don't get too wild. Yeah. Don't cut your hair.
No, I mean, so I think, I think that shows the tensions in, like, our expectation for women and how, you know, we have moved, you know, there's a sexual revolution, right? We move forward, but at the same time, we're always kind of lashed to these 1950s kind of expectations from the past. And that's not just on The Bachelor, that's in life.
Yeah, that's so true. And I think one thing that you point out in the book that was really eye-opening for me is the way that sort of the conventional femininity that contestants are expected to display kind of allows almost them to act in more shocking ways and kind of like gives us a tether. So that when Hannah Brown, for example, can say, I had sex 3 times in a windmill and Jesus still loves me, that might land differently than if she weren't like a very conventionally beautiful, well-groomed, feminine, blonde, white woman in a gown. Like, we're able to receive that differently than someone in a less privileged body and a less traditionally feminine presentation. And so that has definitely shifted how I think about some of these moments of like sexual freedom mm-hmm. on the show, because they always come with that caveat.
Yeah.
Well, and it's always like who gets to be free, right? Who and what mm-hmm. groups, right? And that's not just true about, you know, who gets to be free in terms of their sexuality, but who gets to be free in terms of, you know, how they decide to form a family, like what motherhood is, right? Like any of these social constructs, the people in that privileged category are going to have more freedom.
Yeah, definitely. And we're going to dive more into some of those questions after we take a quick break. We'll be right back with more from Danielle Lindman.
Can you keep up? I like love it.
Let me set the scene. Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at actually unbeatable prices.
I love it.
Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach.
Like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry.
The best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. We truly love to see it.
By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us.
And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes.
I love Quince, and I actually have a couple recent Quince purchases that I'm really excited about. I just ordered the Glow Boho hoops to have like kind of a chunkier version of my usual gold hoops to wear, like maybe on a date night or something. And they are beautiful. They're everything I dreamed of.
Indulge in affordable luxury.
Go to quince.com/LTSI for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns.
That's quince.com/LTSI to get free shipping and 365-day returns.
quince.com/LTSI.
And we're back. And we have much more with author Danielle J. Lindman. So, Danielle, one of the things you talk about in the book, and something that many critics, including ourselves, have observed for a long time, is that the Bachelor franchise has a really long history as a fundamentally white show and a white cultural space. How does the overwhelming whiteness of the show's cast and cultural references affect how viewers react to the show and how they might react to casts of color as we've seen the show diversify over the last couple of years?
I think one of the things that's important to point out about sort of the whiteness and sort of lack of diversity on The Bachelor is that it's not just on The Bachelor, right? It reflects the kind of white privilege that exists in everyday life. It reflects the way that the homophily, like we talked about earlier, it reflects the way that people tend to pair up with other people who are quote unquote like them in terms of race, socioeconomics, and what have you. So, you know, people often say, well, you know, The Bachelor is this, you know, kind of white, has historically been, and it's changing, right? But has historically been this kind of white space. And this is a different question from what The Bachelor should do or has the moral responsibility to do, which I think is a separate question. But in many ways, the space of The Bachelor does reflect real life, which is racially stratified, right? In terms of where we go to school, in terms of where we live, in terms of who we date. A lot of white people don't even have a single Black friend, right? So it is kind of instructive to look at the world of The Bachelor, you know, and there has been this critique of The Bachelor that it is, you know, very much a white space. But I think it's important to understand the ways that that reflects broader society in which there are still a whole lot of white spaces, which I don't think necessarily answered your question. But again, I think it's important to point out that, you know, yes, we can absolutely be critical of The Bachelor for its lack of diversity. But at the same time, it's important to think about kind of where that comes from and what that reflects.
Right. The Bachelor does not exist in a vacuum.
Exactly.
Like, and it is interesting because when you watch the very first season of the show, you don't see the extreme overwhelming whiteness that we then got in the subsequent kind of chunk of seasons. And so clearly they were, in some capacity, reacting to who is connecting to the messaging of the show, who is kind of interested in being within this culturally white setting. And it was like white evangelical 24-year-old blondes.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, and of course, you know, they threw in some people of color. It became, to the extent that it became this kind of cultural meme, right, where it was even parodied on SNL, right, this idea that, okay, we're going to throw in a few people of color, but they're not really serious contenders, right? They kind of exist to sometimes be sounding boards for the white people on the show who are obviously going to be, you know, the main focus. Mm-hmm. And I think that, again, shows us kind of how people of color are marginalized and sidelined in everyday life.
Yeah. You write a lot in the book about race and the idea of controlling images. And I was curious if you could, like, maybe explain what controlling images are and what are some common examples of that that we might be likely to see on a show like The Bachelor.
So controlling images, this is sociologist Patricia Hill Collins's term for basically cultural images that we sort of deploy, and typically of marginalized people. So, you know, people of color, women, marginalized people in marginalized sexual categories. So there's sort of these images that we deploy that ultimately present marginalized people in certain stereotypical ways, and they function to kind of uphold the kind of standard arrangement of power. So if we see like a low-income person being portrayed as a buffoon on reality TV, that helps us kind of justify for ourselves the fact that there is this, you know, immense class inequality, especially in our country, and to kind of justify and rationalize and explain away, oh, well, but that person is where they kind of belong because they behave in this kind of particular way. And we see this with kind of racial stereotypes as well on shows like, you know, The Real Housewives and Married to Medicine. I'd actually be interested, I know I'm not the one interviewing you, but I would actually be interested in kind of your thoughts on it, especially in kind of the earlier seasons or even throughout the show. I don't necessarily feel like The Bachelor kind of relies on racial stereotyping to the extent that we see it in other forms of reality TV. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment, or are there more that I'm not thinking?
I think something you talk about in the book is the absence of certain,
yes,
you know, groups of people, and the way that that is almost can be just as potent as an exaggerated, you know, controlling image. And I think that's probably more what The Bachelor has relied upon, like this idea that, as you said, you know, for a long time, it was like every person of color would go home by week three. And so the implication is just people in those bodies are not desirable, are not to be paid attention to. We still, as you point out in the book, rarely see, you know, Asian men cast mm-hmm. on The Bachelorette, and if they are, rarely see them go far. And that just speaks to the fact that there is a stereotype in our culture of Asian men as asexual and undesirable. And so I feel like that absence is really what The Bachelor has played with or relied upon to kind of perpetuate the racial and gender-based structures that we see in the culture.
Yeah, that's a good point. And that definitely struck me as well reading. I think that, like, as the show tries to figure out how to respond to various lawsuits and critiques about diversity, there is like a sort of discomfort that they're showing about how to do that without falling back on those stereotypes. And I think I think often of in Rachel Lindsay's season, the first Black Bachelorette, how a man was cast who was publicly racist, and also a number of Black men who ended up being sort of pushed into conflict and being described by him as aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, the show is trying to perhaps present the racist man as a villain, but they are also sort of in a two-for-one getting Black men that they can present as being
angry,
you know, angry and therefore, in their own way, sort of not the kind of man that you are going to end up with at the end of a show about love and dating. So Kenny King, for example, ended up being framed as sort of the angry black man, even though we were given this sort of justification for his anger. And so I think the show does, as it's trying to evolve, is falling back on some of those tools as well.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Oh, I was going to say about Kenny. I mean, to me, that was a fast. I loved Kenny. Kenny is one of my favorite contestants of all time. But the Kenny exchange was really interesting to me because if I recall correctly, there was kind of a fourth wall coming down there where, you know, Kenny's kind of explained that, like, he's realizing, right? And I think that there's kind of been a shift, right, in reality TV where now, not that people of color like haven't always realized, right, but, like, they're talking about it, and that's actually airing, right? And we don't just see it on The Bachelor. We see it on shows like Real Housewives of Potomac or Married to Medicine, where people are saying, okay, but when you talk about me in that way, you're drawing upon this kind of from this well of stereotypes, and it becomes kind of almost educational for the viewer in a way. And I feel like, yes, it did portray Kenny in that way, but he kind of wouldn't bite. Right. He knew, like, you knew that Kenny knew what was going down in that moment. And he said, no, I'm not going to play this game. I'm not going to be like kind of pigeonholed into becoming this angry black man character, which is fascinating.
Yeah. But yeah, I think there is some level. I think the show is like has some at least amount of positive in intention. And so I think there is this fundamental tension that we're seeing on the show where they're like trying to take, you know, a couple steps forward, and then they end up kind of splitting the difference and like falling back on these stereotypes and playing into these stereotypes while also trying to show that these contestants are more than that. And so as a sociological text, I think it can be really, really useful. It just unfortunately often has a pretty negative impact on the people who are put in those situations to begin with.
Yeah. Oh, I wanted to just briefly before we move on, bring up the question also of just like these as real people are sort of navigating. They're aware that they are going to be presenting themselves in these spaces on these shows. And so they have to also navigate questions like how their behavior will be received, specifically maybe compared to other types of people displaying those behaviors. And so you write about, for example, a black mom on Dance Moms who has to be much more measured than the various white moms who are dealing with the extremely terrifying sounding dance coach. How do we see that playing out as The Bachelor is trying to diversify and people of color being sort of put into this space that is historically like for a white audience, courts a white audience, and is a white space?
Yeah, I mean, it's fast, especially when you look at, you know, Rachel, right, coming on as the first black bachelorette, right? She had to be absolutely perfect in every way, or she was going to be torn apart. I think it's interesting, as I write about in the book, right, where there was that infamous tweet, right, where it was a former cast member who said, you know, what is this, love and hip hop, right? And then there was that kind of a backlash against that, right? But what does that tweet say? That tweet says, oh, what is this person of color doing here in this space that has historically been really reserved for white people with the occasional, like, black person who we know is not very serious and not going to get very far kind of thrown in. So I think, yes, I think that the show's absolutely, they're trying to diversify. They're trying to change. As a person, I think that that's a positive thing. But I think it remains to be seen whether, you know, this is just going to kind of reify existing racial stereotypes. You know, someone was asking me earlier, you know, can reality TV be saved, or is it always going to be kind of racist and sexist? And maybe you too have thoughts, but I don't really have an answer to that. I can't really imagine a reality TV that is not like so deeply, is not really drawing from these wells of stereotypes in such a way.
Well, it's also like a question of are we going to have a culture that isn't racist and
right.
sexist? And right now, I mean, we're trying, but got a long way to go. So I can't imagine that reality TV is going to somehow turn in overnight into this like bastion of equality when we live in a fundamentally unequal society that is like literally built on perpetuating that inequality.
I think that's such a fantastic point. I bring that up all the time, right? Again, we talked about how people are critical of the fact that we consume these programs. We always kind of feel like we have to justify, you know, because they are, you know, they are sexist and racist and classist in a lot of ways. But, you know, turn on the TV and the commercial for Tide is going to be, I don't know about racist, but it will be probably sexist, right? I mean, just the material that we consume in our everyday life, like much of it struggles with the same issues of inequality that reality TV struggles with, right? So yes, all this culture that we consume is reflecting our longstanding social inequalities. And that's, you know, it's problematic, but it doesn't set reality TV apart, as you said.
Yeah. So we wanted to change tax a little bit here and talk about the question of like script breaking, which I found so fascinating as I was reading your book. And some of the most like iconic Bachelor moments have come from the show's script being broken in some way. There are all these expectations, like we've talked about how people navigate this process. And then when that script is broken in some way, you mentioned Andy Dorfman after the Fantasy Suite date, sort of challenging Juan Pablo, the lead, for not being interested in her during that private time. And she doesn't play into the idea that this was a sort of beautiful romantic interlude. And also like Colton ending his season by trying to run away and pursue a woman who had dumped him, which is something I think we very rarely see, is a man on the franchise being willing to be like submissive in some way to a woman who has rejected him. Obviously that turned much darker after the show mm-hmm. wrapped. But I'm curious, like, what makes these moments of script breaking so powerful? And what would that, like, maybe look like in a world where we don't, perhaps in a utopian world, where we didn't live by such rigid scripts and roles?
Well, I think, you know, in general, you know, there's this thing in sociology called ethnomethodology, where you basically, it's kind of fun. I have my students do it. Like, you break social rules, and by breaking social rules, you can kind of better understand the social rules. And I kind of see that as what's happening with someone like Andy Dorfman, which I write about in the book, though not as connected to ethnomethodology, which is now what I'm thinking of. but it kind of shows us how we kind of talked about, right, how these shows kind of show us how our expectations for relationships are built on kind of the shifting sands of culture, right? Like, these are all these expectations. They're not biological and essential and everlasting, right? They're things that we were socialized to learn. They were expectations that we were socialized into, right? Like, this idea that obviously a woman should be kind of sexually available to a man. She should be happy to be pursued by a man. She should put herself aside and think about his interests, right? And suddenly, you know, Andy didn't want to play that game, right? And so she's breaking not only the script of The Bachelor, which is like this fiction that overrides The Bachelor, that everyone just automatically is going to be in love with this guy that they meet. Like, just mathematically, that seems kind of unusual, right? But, you know, but that within the fiction of The Bachelor, okay, I'm on board with that, right? But not only that script, right, but she's breaking kind of these cultural scripts we have for women and gender and dating. And it's by breaking those scripts. I, too, am really fascinated by these moments of kind of script breaking, because by breaking the script, then we can understand what the script is in the first place.
Yeah, that when you say that, I'm now thinking of the moment when in the season premiere this season with Clayton, where one of the women named Claire, because she is a heroine, decides she's not into Clayton, and the other women react to this in a way that seems so revealing to me, which is like, what's wrong with you for not liking Clayton? Any woman who doesn't want to marry Clayton is broken in some way.
And therefore, she needed to be like cast out. She needed to be punished for sidestepping this rule. Like, you can't have people in this space for long who aren't willing to buy into the like universal desirability that we want to believe The Bachelor has.
It's almost like she's like, she's noticed the Emperor has no clothes, and instead of quietly leaving, she's like, everyone, the Emperor has no clothes. And in that moment, she's revealing that we're all just pretending that it's normal for every woman who happens to be in a space to be in love with the only man who's there. And I don't think I've ever quite seen that happen on the show before. And it was really, really eye-opening about what we're saying about women and what they desire in men, which is that they are exactly like Clayton, I guess.
They're there.
They're tall.
They're there and tall.
They're there, they're tall.
So something that we've also been fascinated with, because obviously we're a part of it, is the ecosystem that exists around a lot of reality shows, like the live tweeting, the Instagramming, the gossip, the podcasts. And so we often think about reality TV like as a community building tool. Like, how does it function in that way, from what you've observed?
So this is fascinating too. So sort of studies show, right, that we still stigmatize reality TV. So on the one hand, it's like this guilty pleasure that we're not supposed to admit that we like. We're not really supposed to talk about at parties, even if we do, right? But on the other hand, it's kind of paradoxical because, first of all, more of us are watching than not, as we pointed out, millions of us are watching. But studies also show that one of the reasons that we keep tuning in is because it serves this kind of communal function, right? You know, I was saying before, it's similar to football in some ways. This is one of the ways that it's similar to football. You root for your team, right? Like, the Real Housewives reunions are my Super Bowl, right? And I connect with my friends, and not just my friends, but people kind of across class positions, like people from kind of all walks of life about these shows. So it's really interesting because it's supposed to be this like guilty pleasure. It's stigmatized. It's kind of dirty. We don't really want to admit to watching it. But at the same time, so many of us are watching it that it is really surfing this kind of solidaristic, like communal function within society where we're connecting with friends. We're having watch parties. We're listening to podcasts, right? We are on message boards and on social media, and we're tweeting at the stars and at each other about the things that we see on the show. So it's really this fascinating duality to me where on one level we kind of reject it and it's supposedly this kind of deviant practice. But on the other hand, it's bringing us, a lot of us, closer together.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, that's literally why we have a job. I mean,
thank you to reality TV.
Yeah.
It's also interesting the way that we always talk about sports serving this function across class and race and so many elements of how we categorize ourselves. But gender is like such a fundamental dividing line in a certain way that like, I never feel like, oh, if I have to make conversation with a man, I can definitely just bring up Real Housewives and we'll have something to talk about. And I think that's sort of interesting as well. It's more likely that women will be like, well, I have to learn something about sports so I can talk to men that I have to get along with, than vice versa.
That's so true.
That stigma playing into it again.
But you would be surprised at how many men end up knowing things about reality TV. And it's not always because they're lying about not watching, which sometimes they are, right? But, you know, it's out there, right, in the cultural ether. So even if you're not watching, you read about it in, like, regular news media. It's on social media. It's inescapable, sort of. It's out there. So I think you could connect with some men around reality TV shows. Maybe it depends on the shows.
I mean, my boyfriend has just absorbed a lot by osmosis, despite the fact that he does not enjoy reality TV at all. But he knows so much.
Yes.
Yeah.
I say that about my husband all the time. He's not a fan at all. But, you know, he'll sometimes end up knowing things about the shows before I do because he reads about it and like, The Washington Post or The Times. He's like, you hear about Colton? I'm like, what? How do you know about this? But he absorbs, right? Like, I'll be watching, like, RuPaul's Drag Race, and he'll walk by and be like, she's so fish. I'm like, what? How do you know what that means? Right? So it's, again, sort of by osmosis, not only for me, but, you know, from the larger culture.
Yeah. No, we, like, if you, like, give your friend, your male friend or partner, some just like a little bit of information about the reality TV they're watching, they start to like soak it in from all angles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, on this show, we always, you know, talk about the different ways you can watch reality TV, that you can do it just as a fan, but also by taking this critical lens that we keep talking about. So one thing that really struck me and made me take a step back was how you wrote about reality TV being also part of this tradition of more well-off people, more educated people, people from a higher social class, kind of reminding themselves of their own superiority, their own perceived superiority by consuming entertainment that is by or for or about people who are in lower social classes. You talk a little bit about like slumming and the history of that. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what slumming really means, like where that comes from and how reality TV plays into that tradition.
Sure. So sociologist named Jennifer Lena writes about slumming, and she sort of writes about how this is kind of, there's long been a history of elites kind of using lower class people as forms of entertainment in order to kind of booster their own senses of superiority. So these slumming parties that happened in like the 1800s in like London and New York, people from the elite classes would go into lower income neighborhoods, and it became this kind of spectacle. Like they had rat pit gambling where they would watch a terrier kill a rat in the ground, right? But can you draw a line from rat pit gambling to watching a show like Here Comes Honey Boo Boo? I think you can, right? So we've kind of been wringing entertainment out of these kind of low class, right, working class stereotypes for hundreds of years. Reality TV is just kind of doing it in a new and maybe more kind of amplified way. And there was a one study in Britain that did show that, I think was it teen boys or college? It was boys or young men were watching these shows, middle class young men were watching these shows to kind of boost, again, their own sense of their class superiority compared to the kind of working class or lower class people on the shows.
Yeah, and something that I found interesting that you talk about in the book is the way that, like, this consumption of low culture, the exchange isn't equal. Like, people from the upper classes might consume that low culture, but it's not as though there's then an exchange where people in lower socioeconomic classes are then having as much access to quote unquote high culture, like opera, for example, which you mentioned before. And that definitely made me think about my own cultural consumption.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can think about, you know, the consumption of reality TV itself, right, through that particular lens. There's sort of a lot been written about how we've become more culturally omnivorous, right? So omnivorous is probably like not a word you've heard since you were like 5 years old and learning about dinosaurs, right? But we consume different types of both high and low culture, right? But who's really doing that? It's the elites who are doing that, who are consuming both high and low culture. And as Jennifer Lena points out, right, doesn't make them any less of elites, right? Elites are still going to be elites. Whether or not you are watching The Real Housewives, you are still going to be a class elite. Just because elites are sometimes dabbling in low culture, you know, the way that the slumming parties happened as well, that doesn't really fundamentally rattle the cage of the class system.
You also bring up in the book this idea of the democratization of taste. And can you explain a little bit what you mean when you write that reality TV can be a key site for the democratization of taste?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really nuanced, right? Because on the one hand, right, I'm an academic. We don't like to give straightforward answers, right? On the one hand, right, you know, as I was just saying, like reality TV shows us that the class system is heartily intact. Even if, you know, Hillary Clinton is, you know, partial to Dorinda on The Real Housewives, even if elites are consuming reality TV or consuming low culture, you know, that doesn't mean that, you know, people from lower social classes are now like watching opera more or ambling through museums more. That's not actually true. So, yeah, the arrow of omnivorousness seems to flow in one direction. And it's mainly kind of elites dabbling and even kind of slumming to an extent. So that's happening. But at the same time, and again, I believe in the transformative power of reality TV. I know we talk a lot about like the ugly stereotypes in reality TV. Absolutely. They need to be talked about. But I really believe in the transformative potential of reality TV. And one of the things I think reality TV has the power to do, and I'm guessing you believe it too because you have this podcast, right, is kind of bring people together around these shows, right? I've had conversations with so many different people, different demographic groups, right, about these shows, and we're kind of bonded in our shared kind of love for what's happening on our screens. And I think, you know, we can harness that in a really kind of productive way where we're not only are we bonding about the things happening on our screens, but we can shift a little and think about it in a critical way, which possibly is the whole point of this podcast. So
we hope so.
I definitely appreciate that. Yeah.
That's definitely what we're going for. And I also loved that you wrote about in the book the ways in which the more kind of fringe reality shows are perhaps the greatest sites for that kind of transformative power. You know, obviously The Bachelor is on ABC, but then we do have all of these smaller cable channels, and there are is like a massive selection of reality shows that exist that have fewer eyeballs on them. But like maybe then that's the way that you can kind of get that real exciting experimentation.
Yeah, so I quote a media scholar named Raquel Gates who writes about what she calls the televisual gutter of reality TV and how there's sometimes more freedom in the gutter, right? Because people aren't necessarily always paying attention or really, you know, giving it as much scrutiny, right? So, you know, the ripples and the back channels of cable, you know, sometimes there's amazing things happening on those shows if you know where to look. And hey, in general, reality TV, I know we talk about its diversity problem, but historically it's been a lot more diverse than other forms of media. And yes, not all those representations are great, absolutely, but there's something to be said for representation, not only in terms of racial representation, but representation of queer people. Reality TV was on the vanguard of queer representation before other forms of media started to catch up. So yes, but I think to some extent you can see that more in shows that aren't, you know, kind of front and center like The Bachelor. The Bachelor is still very kind of conventional, traditional, stratified, heteronormative, gender normative show. But if you kind of know where to look, there's like there's drag queens over there, you know.
Maybe this is a good place to end, but I just am curious, like if you could to a viewer of The Bachelor or similar reality shows out there say, here is like one key thing to keep in mind while you're watching or one tool to use to look at the show. What would you want more people to be implementing to like have in mind as they're watching that they can bring to how they consume these shows?
One thing? Oh, that's really tough. So I think, I mean, again, you know, I tell my students, you don't have to feel bad or guilty about watching these shows. Otherwise, I would feel bad and guilty too. But I think it's really about consuming them with a critical eye and thinking about what are the expectations that underlie the action that you're seeing on the show, especially expectations for people in certain groups. What are the expectations for women, for people of color, for people in certain class positions, right? What expectations are being promulgated here? And to what extent are those expectations kind of biological and essential and unshakable? Spoiler alert, to zero extent, right? All of these expectations are, to some extent, kind of socialized. So I think just it kind of a large frame to put around this is view with the critical eye. Don't stop viewing, but view with the critical eye and an eye toward thinking about the kind of cultural and socialized expectations that underlie the action that you're seeing on your screen.
What I'm taking away from this is that, like, it's okay for us to take the things that might be coded as silly or frivolous that we enjoy and take them seriously and learn from them and think about them in deep and interesting ways, and that the cultural shame that exists around these spaces is perhaps misguided for that reason.
Absolutely. I think that that's 100% true. And I feel like, you know, and that's what you two are doing with this podcast, which I so appreciate as well. I feel like I found my people here. Yeah. People who appreciate this as serious text, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I felt reading the book as well. And it was such a joy to read. I think anyone who listens to this podcast would really get a lot out of this book. It's called True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us. Danielle, thank you so, so much for joining us today. This was so much fun, and I learned even more than I did reading the book.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was a blast.
And that's it for Love to See It with Emma and Claire. Thanks to our guest, Danielle Lindemann. Her book, True Story, What Reality TV Says About Us, is out now.
Love to See It is produced by us, Claire Fallon and Emma Gray, and Stitcher. This episode was edited by Tamika Weatherspoon. Our theme music is by Tamar Haviv, and our art is by Celine Chang. Josephine Martirana is our executive producer.
If you like the show, please rate 5 stars and leave a review. And of course, help us spread the word about our show, especially to your friends who used to listen to us as Here to Make Friends.
If you want to get in touch, you can always email us at claireandemmapod@gmail.com with your questions and voice memos.
You can also find us on Twitter at @LoveToSeeItPod and Instagram at @ClaireandEmmaPod. And you can find our newsletter Rich Text on Substack at claireandemma.substack.com.
I'm on Twitter and Instagram at @EmmaLadyRose.
And I'm at Claire E. Fallon. We'll be back next week to recap the next stage of Clayton's journey. Can you keep up?
Stitcher.